Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim, you're a New Jersey native, so we can say without any sarcasm in our voice, well done, New Jersey. You actually picked a really good choice for governor back in 2009 and electing Chris Christie and essentially firing John Corzine. The guy who once ran Goldman Sachs was apparently jockeying to become Treasury Secretary if there was a second Obama term. That's not going to happen now, probably, since he has now presided over the collapse of MF Global, a commodities and derivatives brokerage house, imploding, as the Washington Post puts it, in spectacular fashion, completing the one-time Wall Street and Washington Grande's remarkable descent. John Corzine has now run a state into the ground and at least one company into the ground. So, in all honesty, well done, New Jersey, for getting this guy out of your hair for 4 years.
Yeah, bankruptcy declarations under Corzine are becoming disturbingly common, I guess you could say. I used to cover Corzine during his Senate days. I was working for a wire service. The Bergen Record was one of our client newspapers. He was always personable enough, but look, John Corzine became senator because he spent about $1 bazillion on his campaign. And then he became governor because he spent about $1 bazillion. And, you know, there were other Democrats who just got smushed out of the way because he was throwing around money around the state. And then there were Republicans who lost because John Corzine spent a lot of it. And it's not like there was ever an enormous amount of deep admiration for John Corzine. I mean, he knew his financial stuff fairly well, but I don't think anybody saw him as a public policy genius. I don't think anyone saw him as a particularly inspiring leader. You can argue pretty effectively this is a man who bought a Senate seat and then bought a governorship. It's one thing if you buy your way into office and then you somehow rise to the duties of those office. If John Corzine had been some sort of fascinating bipartisan deal maker or some innovative policy, but basically he was a pretty much a garden variety Democrat attack dog with a certain soft spot for Wall Street, which obviously is very unpopular at this particular moment. So John Corzine runs in 2009, having presided over a really tough 4 years for the state. Some of that's set by the national economic turmoil that got triggered in the end of 2008. But really a lot of it, you know, I mean, speaking as a New Jerseyan, there were a lot of people who moved out of the state from when I was growing up there. And in a way, New Jersey had always been a place where you had a lot of the benefits of living near New York City or Philadelphia, but a lower tax base, and it was a better quality of life. And year by year, that kind of started to erode. And I kind of noticed that, look, it's one thing to have high taxes. It's another thing to have high taxes and corruption, as New Jersey became just infamous for. And so you ended up with this circumstance in which he was just presiding over this state decline with no real comprehensive plan for how to deal with it, no real, you know, good approach of how to be a great reformer and turn things around. And so he loses office and he jumps and goes to Wall Street. Well, one New York Times columnist is surprised that, you know, having been a governor and once, say, a priority for the Obama administration, Corzine just turns around and goes to Wall Street. And then he starts making these very risky bets, so to speak. And, oh, by the way, the reason the FBI is involved is that apparently several $100 million are now missing from the firm. That's not something you easily misplace in the petty cash drawer, Greg. As of this point, former Governor Corzine has not been indicted. He has not, you know, he's not been frog marched in handcuffs. But, oh, we can hope for that day to come. I see a certain sense of justice here. The RNC is insisting that Obama return all of his donations. And so it is kind of this spectacular mess that illustrates, for all of their, you know, supposed populism and standing up for the little guy, Democrats are every bit as much in bed with the Wall Street types as the Republicans are. And in a way, they may be a little more into the crony capitalist revolving door mentality of this, and that they're very comfortable in having government and unions and big banks all in bed together. And the reason I say that is because at one point, John Corzine was involved with one of the head of the very powerful unions in the state, literally in bed with her. You know, that metaphor seems to apply particularly well in the case of Corzine. So we will see how this shakes out. I think it's just created an enormous embarrassment for the Democratic Party. And Greg, I don't know about you, but I will drink to that.
On to martini number two now. And as delicious as that one might have been, especially for people like Jim who are from New Jersey, this one is just probably going to make you nauseous, because it's not like we hadn't had enough of the Herman Cain story over the past 3 days. The idea of this becoming a short story is hopelessly gone now, because Mark Block goes on special report with Brett Baer and this exchange ensues.
You're charging the Perry campaign with stirring this up.
Absolutely. And quite frankly, this is one of the actions in America that is the reason people don't get involved in politics, all right? The actions of the Perry campaign are despicable. Rick Perry and his campaign owe Herman Cain and his family an apology.
Now, basically, the root of the accusation here is that someone who now works for Perry worked for the National Restaurant Association at the time that these allegations came to light. So the assumption from the Cain campaign is that this story got fed to Perry from Cain's former employee, who I think actually even worked for Cain during his unsuccessful Senate bid in Georgia back in 2003-2004. And so now they're demanding this apology from Perry. Perry, of course, is saying he has nothing to do with this, but somehow has the random instinct to blame the Romney campaign for it. And the Romney campaign is obviously saying that it has nothing to do with this as well. So basically, you either have Herman Cain making an allegation that's not true, the Perry campaign doing some really dirty politics, and even if they didn't, blaming the Romney campaign with even less evidence than the Cain people have makes him look bad. And now Romney is probably looking the best out of all three, but this is just getting disgusting and more disgusting by the day.
It is worth noting, a kind of a late-breaking development as we are recording this podcast, that the employee in question is named Kurt Anderson, who's now affiliated with Perry. Anderson was interviewed on Fox News, and he says he gives permission to any news outlet that he has ever spoken to reveal anything he's ever said. If he had, you know, on background or off the record leaked the information to Politico, this would, you know, permit Politico to say, yes, Kurt Anderson is our guy. That has not happened so far, so it would seem Kurt Anderson is quite confident that no news source is going to come out and say, yes, Kurt Anderson was our source for all of these things. I have been whacked around quite a bit this morning for my assessment in the Morning Jolt, including by some folks who I like and respect a great deal, like Jim Treacher. And so I suppose you can make the argument that without specificity to what Cain is alleged to have done, all of this is a pick your metaphor, witch hunt. The lynching metaphor keeps getting used over and over again. And I'm starting to come around to understanding that issue or that approach, and perhaps I have underplayed that or not recognized the difficulty to Cain of responding to something when the allegations are not. Having said that, what's kind of fascinating here is that Cain is running for president based on his skills as a manager. It's not like he has great legislative history, you know, it's like he's a great military hero. Herman Cain is saying, look, I know how business works. I know how economic works. I'm a good manager. Put me in charge of the entire U.S. government as president of the United States and commander-in-chief. Cain had this issue. Apparently, like 10 days ago, Politico asked questions about this, and they didn't really respond to that for 10 days. So they've known this was out there as a ticking time bomb. The story comes out, and Block goes out there not knowing whether there was a settlement or not. Some people think it's a big deal. Some people don't. There are a lot of people who say, look, I don't like the way Cain has handled it, but I still think he's getting a raw deal in terms of the coverage. And that may very well be the case. In fact, I think you can safely say Politico put a story out there that was missing a central element, which is what precisely he's accused of doing. The version that Cain tells of the, I was comparing the height of my wife, you know, hand gesture, just, you know, kind of comes across as a bizarre complaint. So maybe the women in these circumstances are looking for a cash settlement. Maybe they're making a mountain out of a molehill. It's entirely possible. Now we've got a third one, and now we've got this radio show host out in Iowa who very vaguely suggests that Cain did something inappropriate with his staffers, but he refuses to get specific about it. So somehow we've got these people who keep coming forward but never really telling us what Cain has done. I've just gotten to the point where I just don't like insisting that any political figure has not done something wrong. Because we just don't know. Mark Sanford's staffers were completely blindsided by this. I mean, you just don't know any of these public figures. And when readers write in with this great fury to me, I feel like we should, wait a minute, you don't know Herman Cain. You watch him on TV. You like what he says. You like the guy. But you don't know what happened between him and these staffers. And we may, you know, think, well, because we like him, okay, I hope nothing inappropriate happened. We don't know what happens if these former employees come forward and give a very compelling account. And so I'm worried to see so many Republicans absolutely willing to attach themselves to Herman Cain with the insistence that, no, this man couldn't have done something wrong. And we will see what happens. I just have this terrible feeling that at some point something worse is going to come out. And everyone who had stood up for the fine moral character of Herman Cain is going to have egg on their faces. And that's not something I particularly enjoy saying, and Lord knows I've learned my readers don't like hearing it. Does my approach undermine the notion of innocent until proven guilty? Greg, maybe I've gotten too cynical. I realize I've talked for like 5 minutes straight now. So,
well, speaking of egg on the face, let's go over to Greece. Now it's even crazier because the parliament is in full revolt, it seems, or at least revolt enough to suggest that the prime minister who ordered this national referendum and throwing the entire European and really the global economy into chaos is probably on his way out. He's lost the confidence of lawmakers who are now debating whether or not this referendum is actually going to happen. And so that's an open question. Meanwhile, Obama's over at the G20 summit in France trying to convince Europe to make sure everything's okay with Greece, because if Europe's economy goes in the tank, then, well, his hopes for re-election probably aren't that good either. And let's be honest, that's the thing he really cares about. The idea that this is becoming a more stable situation is becoming less and less true by the day. Well, I don't know exactly how it's going to shake out, but the explosiveness in the Greek parliament definitely suggests that we have more things to worry about than less than we did a few days ago.
I like this description I'd seen in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago, which kind of sum, because you know, folks like me who are not economics or finance folks look at this and say, all right, well, we see the rioting. We know Greece spends too much money. We know that they have an enormous black market economy in which they don't pay taxes into it. Why does this affect us, et cetera? And a good way of putting my understanding is that, look, Greece knew that it was spending more than it could afford. So they needed to borrow money, and they borrowed money from European banks, particularly Greek banks, but also apparently quite a few French banks. And the European banks knew that if they ever ran into trouble, that the governments of Europe would back them up. So basically it's this, you know, this vicious cycle that everybody's tied together, and now there just isn't enough money. So Europe says, all right, and France and Germany say, all right, we will save you one more time. And by the way, all of these efforts to save Greece are apparently temporary. Apparently they never, you know, they're just kicking the can down the road for a couple of years. If that. And they have this circumstance which Greece says, wait a minute, your demands for us to get this, you know, this effort to save us, you're going to require us to institute austerity measures. And by the way, I think for a lot of conservatives, we kind of scoff at what they call austerity measures. The Greeks are not into austerity. And so they say, well, we don't know if we want to take this deal. Now, some people have characterized this as a family in a house that is on fire deciding they're going to vote on whether or not to allow the firemen in. There's a part of me that looks and says, look, if Greece, you know, if Greece doesn't want it, don't make the Greeks do it. If they want to withdraw from the euro, let them withdraw from the euro and let them reap the whirlwind. Now, unfortunately, apparently there'll be many, many consequences beyond this, beyond the borders of Greece. On the other hand, it seems like patience of Germany and France and other European countries with Greece is absolutely at it's gone. Situation seems to change every couple of hours, so we will see what happens. Perhaps by the next three martini lunch, Greece as we know it will not exist. The drachma will be back, and they'll be burning the ruins for warmth or something like that.
It'll be the three shots of ouzo lunch because...
there we go. I should have known you'd be able to handle that metaphor.
Jim, yeah, really slow day in politics today, huh? We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.